RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
All right, let's try and understand potential models for Indigenous autonomy. Coming back onto RCR is Dr. Eric Crampton, who is the Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative. And we're here to talk about, well, around an opinion piece he had published in the Post a couple of weeks ago. The, and I hope I get the pronunciation correct here, the Tzechen First Nation near Chilliwack, British Columbia, is tiny. The band counts 731 members, some 58% of whom live on their lands. Their reserve lands adjacent to the city are not large, but they are growing. Okay, I know you originally from Canada, so you have experience of a bit of history here, and maybe you can see or tell us that it's evolved in that time that you've been observing it, experiencing it. But how did you connect with this? I think you went to an event that the Murray King at the time had pulled together and invited this First Nation group to New Zealand. What, specifically to talk about Indigenous autonomy and how that might work? Is that what that was about?
Oh, cool. Sure. So I guess for long run background, I'd started following this when I saw development going on in British Columbia with the Squamish First Nation there. So the Squamish Nation were given back some land that had been taken from them in the late 1800s. It's 5 hectares near downtown Vancouver had been taken for building railways. And the government never decided to use it for building railways. Finally, they said, okay, well, we took this for a reason that we didn't end up using it for. We're going to give it back to you. That's great. Now, in Canada, Indigenous land that's treated as reserve, it has autonomy on it. So the Squamish spent some time deciding what they wanted to do with that land. They decided that they wanted to build a whole pile of apartments with some retail below, and it's their land, so they could just do it. They didn't have to go begging Vancouver Council for permission to do it. They didn't have to comply with anybody else's zoning rules on it. They have what sounds like rangatiratanga over their land. Now, it did require that they come to a service agreement with the city of Vancouver. So there's a 250-page service agreement where they specify, okay, here's how much the Squamish are going to be setting as tax on their own land to pay for services that they're buying from the city of Vancouver.
So electricity, water connections, sewerage, all of that.
Water connections, sewerage, electricity is handled a little bit separately.
Right.
Payments for contributing to the parks that the city puts on, but recognizing that the band was also putting in their own parks on their land. Neat stuff. So I'd been thinking about this as, well, potential ways forward here for unlocking the use of land that's currently pretty encumbered. Now, jump ahead a little bit. I was on a study tour to British Columbia that was organized by NIB Insurance looking at health system devolution to First Nations there. But as part of that, we took a side trip out to Kamloops to see Manny Jules at the First Nations Tax Commission because he'd done a lot of the work setting up the institutions to allow this to happen. All right, so I learned a fair bit about how that works there. About mid-October, Netahu was the host of the third national hui that the deceased Maori King had asked for building Kohatitanga unity among iwi. And Netahu was the host of that. They decided what the agenda was because the purpose was let the four winds speak, and the South Wind, Netahu, they wanted to talk about this. So they brought over First Nations leaders from Canada just talking about what they have been able to achieve by having proper authority over their own land. And Chief Derek Epps' presentation from Shiachtal Nation near Chilliwack is just astounding because it speaks to the transformation that this happened over the past several decades, because when I was a kid in Canada, First Nations reserves, like, you would never recommend that anybody wanted to do what they were doing. They were not happy places. My high school was next door to the Swan Lake Indian Reserve. It didn't seem like a very happy place. Chief Epp said that in 1990, okay, that's when I was in high school, transfers from the Canadian central government made up 90% of his band's revenues. Okay, so what they were doing to help their people, 90% of the money was coming from Ottawa. It's just free money in from the government. All right. They decided to stop worrying so much about treaty settlements, to deprioritize that path because it wasn't working out. British Columbia still doesn't have a lot of their treaties settled. Instead, they focused on what can we do with what we have? And that was growing because of the work that Chief Manny Jules had been doing at Kamloops, and Chilliwack isn't that far from Kamloops. It's neat to see how the work that he'd done there just started spreading to neighboring reserves and neighboring First Nations, and folks were learning how to take up autonomy because they started being able to set taxes on their own land, use those taxes to fund infrastructure, use those taxes to back the debt that finances infrastructure, set their own zoning on their own land, decide what they want to build for themselves. Now at Shiachtwil, 90% of the band council's revenue is all from business activity that they generate on their own land.
Wow.
And Chief Epp said, we are not dependent on anyone. Just the power of an agency that's provided when you allow people to just get on with things on their own land. He also said that, like, okay, their band is tiny, right? 731 members, as you'd mentioned, but they are building thousands of homes. The homes aren't just for themselves. It's because Chilliwack's a decent-sized town, growing. It's got a housing shortage like everywhere else. They're able to build housing faster than council can authorize it over in Chilliwack.
I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice, and I'm kind of picking up on it myself and feeling sort of that way hearing you talk. Not because I'm desperate for good news, okay, or something, but this sounds so frickin' logical.
Yes!
I mean, why wouldn't you? It solves a whole bunch of issues in one, boom, you got it.
Exactly, right? So dependence on government transfers, it deals with that. They're building their own people. They're building, and they're building not just for themselves, but to solve the housing crisis for everybody else. They're collecting the tax revenue on it to fund the things that they want to do. Now, when Chief Epp was talking about this to the assembled iwi at Tuahiwi Marae at just outside of Christchurch, he talked about the importance that they had placed on fish weirs, because Shiachtwil, in their language, that translates as the place of the fish weir. Okay, so a fish weir is this contraption that they had before Europeans showed up for scooping fish out of the river. So fish are kind of bottleneck, and you scoop them out, and it fed their people. And of course, the river degraded over time, and the river is important to them, as rivers are here for iwi as well. What they're doing is they're using their autonomy over their own land to, well, they're generating revenue. It's successful. They're buying the land that matters to them and using their resources to fix the river that's important to them. Mm. And in their planning, they see a future in which they have fish weirs again. And it's not begging government for it. It's not regulating to compel it. It's them doing it for themselves, not having to ask anybody's permission. I love it.
The way to operate, let's say we operated like that here, or a version of it here or whatever, because we're a smaller country. I get it. And I wonder if, you know, land mass has something to do with this. But anyway,
I'll push back on that, because this is, British Columbia has roughly the same population as New Zealand, and it's got a much smaller fraction of the population who are First Nations. Like 20% of New Zealand is Maori background, maybe 5% of British Columbia. Okay, so.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we can imagine what those autonomous zones would be, because that would map to Maori land, right?
Well, we'll have to remember that the Canadian process took a lot of time.
Yeah.
So Manny Jules started this around 1988 when he got legislative change that would start enabling First Nations to take up tax authority. But that wasn't automatic, because central government was a little bit worried. Well, are they going... When I was a kid, band councils had a reputation of being fairly corrupt and nepotistic, okay? Or at least those were the stories that were told among white farmer types in southern Manitoba. Whether they were true or not, central government needed to have confidence around that, right? So that they knew that it wasn't going to be mishandled.
Okay, well, assuming that is doable, and there's a history of it in other places.
It built confidence over decades. How you do it here, I think you would. What I would love to see is a pathway through which EWI could request to take up autonomy over land that's held as Māori reserves, land that's around the marae, and land that is held under Māori land tenure and subject to the Māori land courts. Okay, because that land really doesn't work very well. And this has been a problem for decades. It's been a problem for, basically forever, right? It's been a problem for at least as long as I've been here. I remember first having heard about it at a New Zealand Economics Association meeting, I think in 2007, when a presenter there was talking about, well, we got all this land, but you can't do anything with it because you need to get 70% of all owners agreeing to any change. And you might be lucky to find 60% of the owners because a lot of them have moved over to Australia and they don't reply to emails.
Yep.
It's a problem. Devolve authority over fixing that to the iwi that's responsible for it, right?
Right.
The iwi that's affiliated with the land. Let different solutions emerge.
Well, they'll sort it out, won't they? They'll want to sort it out.
They'll do a hell of a lot better job than Wellington bureaucrats.
You want to get started, right? So you're going to do everything that you can to get started. And no one would notice anything except development, and then I could choose to go and live there.
Yeah, so I would see it as being kind of like council plus powers. So it's still one law for all. We're all one people, but like Auckland has different rules from Wellington. Right? That's not a problem. It'd be like having a small council next door to existing councils. So they would have council-like authority, but with a plus to it for being able to come up with better structures for Māori-held land. They would, again, like with the Squamish, it took time for them to decide what they wanted to do with their land. It's up to them. It's their land. Here, it might also take time as well. Let people decide what they want to do with it and see what emerges, right?
It takes the aggro out of it because you're not facing off person to person anymore. It's practical, it's logical, and good luck to everybody is kind of the feeling I'm left with. And I'm not saying, hey, you can't try and take over the country and things like that.
It seems an awful lot less acrimonious a way forward than the debates that we're currently having.
Did you get much of a response to the piece you wrote? Because like I say, it kind of energized me just thinking about it. Because I want to know how we're going to solve all this, and it's maybe not the total answer, but it ticks a lot of boxes. Did you get an enthusiastic response from others?
Well, the most important response was at the Hui Amatu, right? Because you had all of the assembled iwi leaders there hearing what was happening in Canada.
Okay, of course, illogical. Right? I should have asked it. What do they make of it?
Generally supportive. There was some pushback about whether the development that is enabled on reserves is consistent with Māori ways of doing things. And of course, that's up to them themselves, right?
I mean, if I wanted to do something that was me on my land, it's the same thing. I'd do it.
That's right. You shouldn't have to go and prove that what you're going to do on the land is sufficiently you for you to be able to do it on your land.
Yeah.
Instead, you should be able to decide that for yourself with autonomy over your own land, right? Mm-hmm. So it's which comes first, the cart or the horse there. So there's some enthusiasm there. The other bit that I really like, so Manny Jules was one of the speakers. So Chief Derek Epp was great. And actually, I can send you the link because the live stream is available.
We can put it up with the replay, the link. Yes,
yeah, so we can put it up with the replay. And the whole thing was really, really long. So I'll give you some time markers of where the interesting bits were.
Okay.
Chief Derek's talk was a must hear. And parts of Manny Jules' talk as well, because they're just some gems in the things that he had to say. Because he's had decades of working this up. And actually, it started with his father. Okay, so it's been generations working on this at Kamloops. One of his messages was that you can't fix a flat tire by yelling at it.
Yeah, that's true.
You just got to start doing. And his other one was, now I'm going to be doing a terrible paraphrase, but it's consistent with what he was saying. But it's more, you find the people who see the world as you do, and you work with them to achieve things rather than trying to convince everybody at once. So to me,
that's kind of what we all do anyway, in the end.
Yeah, it's the only thing that works. So I'd see it there as really hoping that the government would be receptive if a pitch came to them from EUE saying, look, we know what we're doing. We're happy to take standard audit processes on the accounts. Look, EUE run businesses are huge already. It's not like they have competence in this stuff, right?
Going through it already, yeah.
Put some probity on it. Let's get some devolved authority and see if it works, right?
Yeah.
Try it out with somebody who's ready to go.
And
then let it spread among those who want to do it, but don't require it. Even in Canada, it's still just spreading. So I'm going from memory here, but I think that it was on the order of about 500 First Nations that had taken up taxation authority. It's not all of them yet. For some of them, it doesn't make sense. You leave it up to them to decide what works for best for them. It's an option, not a requirement.
I suppose they could fail as well, and you have to be able to handle that. I mean, you're talking about your experience far more than I've had, but I visited Arizona quite a few times from the early 80s to, you know, recently, and I've seen some of the reservations around there, and pretty sad.
Oh, sure. Now, what I want to caution here is there are still tons of problems both in Canada and the U.S., so the good stuff in Canada is happening despite some of the problems in the Indian Act. So there, like, for example, they have a lot of the problems that are similar to the problems we have with EWE held land, where it is very difficult to get a mortgage on it because it's been difficult for banks to enforce a foreclosure on reserve land. And then you need complicated legal structures to get around that. The Indian Act still requires going to get permission from Ottawa for some stuff. We don't have to do the dumb parts of it here, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember going, just thinking about it now, to a place in Florida, Immokalee, which is close to the Everglades, and that's a smallish Indian kind of reservation, and Immokalee is the big town in it. And we were there and going for dinner, and all these people were walking towards something. It was like some weird movie. And we followed it, and it was to the casino, because that was what underpinned their income. And I didn't think that was too flash, watching these zombies walking towards them.
That's the case in a lot of the American First Nations reserves. And then you get into difficulties there where there might have been like one person left in a First Nation, in a tribe, and then they get a casino authority, and it's, you have to sort out who's going to be a band member or not. In Canada, they don't quite have that problem. They've got this weird system where you are either a status Indian or you're not. And if you are, then you've got an Indian, you've got your number, your treaty number, you got your card from from the government of Canada. And if you marry somebody who is a non-status Indian, your kid will be status. But if they marry a non-status Indian, their kid will not be status.
Okay.
So it's a fairly prescriptive system. Yes. You wouldn't want to run that here.
I don't think you could. It's too spread out, isn't it?
It's dumb, right? Like what you just need here is authority over the defined bit of land and treat it like our local council.
All right. Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's neat. It's got a lot of promise.
I quite like it. But I can see that you can't just jump straight into it. But I can see that, you know, becoming something, potentially.
There's capacity for it. So one of the things that's been important for building capability in Canada has been what they call the Tulo Center. It's a research center associated with Thompson River University in Kamloops. That's where Manny Jules is with the First Nations Tax Commission. They've been training a generation of First Nations, basically council bureaucrats, council officials. Yeah. How do you do tax administration? How do you do land use planning? How do you do infrastructure management? You go there, you learn how to do it and apply it within some of the messes of the Indian Act so that you can still make it work on a reserve. They train people to be able to run things. Fun bit, the Tulo Center is partnered with the Netahu Research Center.
Okay, so there's a direct line and a model. Yeah.
Yep. It all works.
Anything we've missed?
I just love the shift from kind of deficit thinking about Man, we've got a lot of problems and we need to beg government for solutions. The shift from that to an enabling one where it's, we've got a lot of resource, just let us use it.
Yep. Eric Crampton, always good to have you on RCR. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for the chat. It's been great.
RCR is on a mission to revive honest media. It's a good mission. And now you can be an integral part of it by joining the RCR Foundation Members Club. Receive exclusive benefits only available to club members, including discounted merch, your backstage pass to join the host for interactive behind-the-scenes discussions, and the popular daily curated news summary, RCR Bytes. Delivered to your email inbox every weekday morning, keeping you on the pulse of the news that matters in just a few minutes per day. To find out more, check out www.realitycheck.radio/members or click the FMC button on the bottom right of your RCR app.